Today is June 16th, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, today I am interviewing Pedro Velasco over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Mr. Velasco, is it okay if I call you Pete?
Yes, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
I'm okay.
Okay. Pete, when and where were you born?
I was born in Honolulu, Hawaii. And I was born in a town called Kaka'ako. And then later on, moved to the Hawaiian homestead land in Papakolea. And I've been there. I was raised there, and then now I'm living on the island of Hawaii.
Hmm. Tell me a little bit about your family.
I have 7 children and 17 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. What about your family when you were growing up? How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I was the only child. And then my stepdad, who was a wonderful man, gave my mom a girl and a boy. And since then, they're all been deceased, and I'm the only living person. Mm-hmm. And likewise, my wife, she never saw her dad. So both of us have never seen our dad, and both of us are the only child.
Oh, wow. And now you have a big family.
Yes, and the youngest of 7 is 50.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So Pedro, or Pete, what year were you born?
I was born April 6, 1937.
Okay. So, Pete, what were your earliest athletic pursuits? What were the first kind of athletic things or sports that you participated in when you were growing up?
Well, because the homestead was like your projects, but except it was a little bit more decent because it was regular lease land, yeah?
Okay.
And the lease was for 65 years, yeah. And that was for, you had to be a certain amount of pot Hawaiian, yeah, to qualify.
Mm-hmm.
So in my growing up, all I know about my dad was he was a boxer. And he was responsible for... He was a territorial champion when Hawaii was a territory. And then my wife's father was a golfer, as far as we know.
Hmm.
And my early childhood athletics was a no-no because my mom hated watching my dad hit people in the head. And my grandmother and grandfather hated athletics because my uncle almost died of a football injury. So that, you know, was a no-no for me. So sports was never something that I even thought about. But because of the gay people in the community, my mother and my grandmother never saw violence. So that's how I got out into the recreation scene. And so my early childhood, I was like anybody else in the projects, playing football on the street and then starting to develop half-truths because I would come home and my grandmother would see me and I'd get a big lump on my head and she would say, you know, what happened, and I would say I was running for the ball, and I wouldn't say what ball I was running for, and then I ran into the pole. I didn't say what pole I was running to, you know. But that's how I started my athletic career.
Hmm. How did you first get involved in volleyball?
Well, volleyball was something that my mentor was interested in teaching me how to become a boxer. And his entire education was in Kolau Boys School, which is the correctional school, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then he taught me everything I know today in athletics as far as volleyball was concerned. He taught me how to play sports on mathematical triangles.
Hmm. What explain that to me.
Okay. He taught me I went to college on a basketball scholarship. And I went to Denver University on a basketball scholarship. So he taught me how to play at my waistline so that my back and my legs were sturdy and straight. He taught me all the fundamentals, and everything was all based on mathematical triangles. So, for example, from when the ball was spiked to the person blocking to the person digging the ball, if you draw a line, then everything is in triangles. Whether it's small, big, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But everything was. And that's how I learned athletics.
Mm.
And I never played with my peers, so I was always playing with people that were 5, 10, 15 to 20 years older than I was.
Hmm.
So that's basically my athletic experience.
Yeah.
Growing up.
So were most of the people that you knew in volleyball, were they your friends as well as people that you played with?
What happened was, while attending Denver University, one of my friends from the island, who retired as a principal, yeah, for the state of Hawaii, he was a member at Denver YMCA, and I usually go home on the weekends with them, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just back from the Korean War, and they were the flunkies from the University of Hawaii, so they were going back on the GI Bill to finish their education. So one day, you know, I was going to go down to his place on the weekend and visit with him, and he said, oh, he had to work out at the YMCA, so if I didn't mind waiting for him, I said, oh, no, no. And I saw some people playing volleyball, and it was a 10-minute observation, and I said, I can play with them, you know. And he said, you sure? And I said, yes, I think I can play with them. And that's how I got exposed. And coach at that time was an Air Force jet pilot on the, you know, the air security for the U.S. And his wife was the former general's daughter. And he became my first coach. And that's how I got exposed to volleyball in the USVBA at the time.
Hmm. What was his name again?
I don't know the coach. I don't know the name of the coach. I forgot. Because eventually he became the athletic director and coach for the Air Force Academy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't remember his name.
Hmm.
But he was a nice man. But that's how I got exposed to USVBA volleyball.
Okay. Well, Pete, when you first started playing volleyball, when you were first introduced to it, did you have any major influences at the time, people that you looked up to or sought to imitate?
No. The only person I remember was my mentor, only coached four of us, and I was the only one that survived. Because he was from the Oriental. He was Japanese Hawaiian. So he gave me the Oriental discipline. And because everything he shared with me presented a logical experience, I never questioned. I went with blind faith and trust. And whatever he told me, I would do. But at the end of one practice, this gentleman who was in high school at the time, because I was only in elementary, yeah, and he was maybe only 5'9", and I remember him at the end of practice taking two steps, jumping to the basketball rim and resting on his arms on the rim and his legs dangling. And I told the coach, I said, "Coach, I want to jump like that." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Okay, then you just do what I tell you to do." And that's how I got involved.
And what did he tell you to do to jump like that?
Well, everything was done in the ocean. I trained in the water. Way before they even brought horses into the water, I was already doing things in the water. And, you know, you don't realize that, but mathematically, the heaviest mass is liquid. And so there's the ocean, right? You got the current and everything. So, and that's how I train.
That's fascinating. Huh. So tell me about the road to the first Olympic trials you were in. You tried out for the 64 team, and you were on the 64 team?
Yes. So, and on the 64 team, I was elected by the members on being the first coach, I mean, captain of the first Olympic team, yeah.
Oh, wow. So was this the... was 64 the first time men's volleyball was in the...
Well, 64 was the first time volleyball was introduced as an activity.
Oh,
the
okay.
The host country is the only country that can add and delete activities.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then so, you know, when I went on the 68, I was already chosen to be the captain of the 68 team, but I told my coach that I had my turn. Give it to somebody else, yeah. Let them have an experience that I experienced, yeah.
Hmm. Pete, could you tell me about the 1964 trials, what those were like? Did you have any...
Well, the trials at that time was not the way it is today. The trials at that time were, you know, if you were in the first and second place, then you were considered as an All-American and then possibly a part of the Pan American or Olympic team, yeah. And I was fortunate to have done it from a third place standing. And I guess it was never done like that before, yeah.
Mm.
So, you know, I before the Olympics, I made All-American as a spiker. And then after the Olympics, I made All-American as a sitter.
Tell me about your experience in Tokyo, a little bit about your experience in Tokyo. We'll focus on Mexico City, but I do want to know.
In Tokyo, it was we were made aware of what is now known as the Kwikset, but at the time, I was informed that Russia and Japan went to China to train, and the Chinese gave them a good educational lesson in the sport, but they were not allowed into the Olympics at the time. China, that is what I'm talking about. So we were exposed to what is known as the Kwikset, which at that time, the only way I could remember it, because the Japanese introduced it, so I used to call it the Japset. But it wasn't a remark towards racists. It was, for me, the easiest way to remember. Yeah.
Okay.
It was the easiest way for me to remember what the set looked like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in the process, they would run around. After a play, they all would run around, the Russians and the Japanese. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then so what happened was I created a number system so that I could remember who was in the front row and who was in the back row. So a lot of the stuff I was taught by my mentor to learn how to integrate certain things, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always taught, you take what you want from every ethnic group and you leave what you don't want, but what you take, you now must integrate in your lifestyle. And that's how I learned. He was so far ahead of his time. Until I became a school teacher, then I understood why his entire education was in the boys' reformatory school. Because when you're intelligent and the educators do not understand how to challenge your brain, several things happen. One, the most obvious, becomes you're bored. Two, the next thing that happens from this boredom is you become disruptive. And then the third issue from this disruption becomes you become labeled very mischievous. And so the educators label you to become this person, so you become that person. But to retire as a master electrician, something had to be wrong with that picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. But that's how he taught me. He taught me how to become a walking computer. And, you know, you don't wait for your coaches to bring you all of the statistics. Your eyes, your ears become your support system for you to make a decision ASAP. And not wait until everybody performs their mission and then give you all the data. It's too late. So I was taught how to be a walking computer. And even the, you know, trying to do coaching from walkie-talkie. I already wanted to do that long, long time ago. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very fortunate that my coach was way ahead of his time. You know, everything I saw in the 64 Olympics, it didn't shock me. It was just a different word for the different type of set.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was already exposed to it by my coach. Yeah.
I see. So when you were in the 64 games, you were 27. So I assume at that time you were already married and had children. And
Yes, I was married and 7 children. And but I was very committed to wanting to be the best in whatever I do. So even though I was married and had 7 children, I had a 27-inch waist, and I was between 190 and 200 pounds. So physically and mentally, I was the strongest. And so I was also made aware that your most productive years are when you're 27 to 37. As your productive years. That's not necessarily your end of your playing career. No, it's just that you're most productive during that period of time.
I see. And who how were you made aware of this?
Oh, by just asking my coach, and my coach always was there for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
So, Pete, you talked a little bit about being aware of how how other people trained. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Okay. I used to be a fanatic in observing martial arts films because I wanted to utilize certain training techniques into my training in a regimen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that watching the martial art movies and at the same time using it as a method of speed reading for my children, because at the time I only had a year and one semester of higher education because I had dropped out of college, yeah, during my freshman year, because I knew I was going to go home and marry my wife. And so I wasn't ready for school. I was ready for life, but I wasn't ready for school.
Mm.
So, you know, and then that kind of motivated, you know, like, men take a lot for granted. They, you know, they don't realize that the wife's job is 24/7. And, you know, as soon as they can realize that and become a part of that teamwork, then your marriage life is very wonderful.
Hmm.
Why did you make that remark?
Why was I asking you about,
yeah.
just curious, really.
Well, you know, now my wife and I, you know, I went with my wife when she was only in the 8th grade and I was in the 10th grade.
Oh.
And we're still together. And so this coming December, we'll be married for 58 years.
Wow, that's really amazing. So Pete, you know, because you had a big family and you were married and everything, how was your training and competition supported? Like, how were you able to afford to take time to train and to travel and to compete?
See, during that time, as soon as you can make the Olympic team, then they have a stipend. Outside of that, it was your responsibility to figure out how you're going to finance everything, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So it just happened that the partner that I had, you know, playing doubles and everything was a banker. And he would give me 6 months interest-free loans. And that's how I supported myself. And then I had some very decent, you know, jobs. Like I worked for Matson, which is one of the biggest, you know, steamship companies in Hawaii. And then I was fortunate to work for Pan American Airlines. Yeah, so, you know, that's how I supported myself and my family.
Okay. So once you had made the Olympic team in 1964, how did your friends and family and employer, people who knew you in the community, how did they react to finding out that you had made, that you were, you know, a captain on the 1964 Olympic team?
Well, you know, I was already kind of like the athletic stud coming out from the state of Hawaii. Because of my high school accomplishments, because I was a basketball player, yeah? Mm-hmm. I never played volleyball in high school, because there was no such thing as volleyball at that time. So, you know, I was fortunate to get a full scholarship just on my performance and newspaper clippings. And my coach was a very, very influential person in my life at that time, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a mathematician because he had his doctorate in math. And so it was interesting that, you know, he did not know that I understood how to do things mathematically too, yeah.
Mm.
You know, and he did not know that my life was never with my peers. So, you know, when we had a basketball practice, and, you know, like they say, when you're going with your left hand on the left side, you lay it up with your left hand. But somebody came in my way, so I just switched and I put it up with my right hand. And boy, did he come after me and say, you know, you're a smart ass. You know, I said, no, I'm not, you know. And then, you know, he just had a session, one-on-one session with me. And he told everybody, okay, you can go, but Pete got to stay back. And everybody was curious what's happening. So he and I had a one-on-one session. And then, you know, he found out that I was kind of like advanced for my age because he wanted to teach me how to play like an adult, but he didn't know that I was always playing with adults, yeah?
Mm.
You know, so I was ready, but I just wasn't ready for school,
mm-hmm.
You know?
So. Yeah. Well, let's switch gears from 64 to 68. Can you describe the training regimen for 68?
Okay, 68, we went to Lake Tahoe, mm-hmm. to get altitude training, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then it was a very good experience because for me, in my daily training, because nobody saw me train. I trained by myself. What I would do would be, you know, to find out where the nationals was going to be and then find out what is the coldest temperature and what is the hottest temperature. And then I would train according to what I thought would be an equivalent to those two temperatures. So I was training like 3 o'clock in the morning. I was training like 3 o'clock in the afternoon just to acclimate my body to what I thought would be the similar temperatures to the national championship site. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I trained. Nobody saw me train. I just trained by myself because I always wanted to be the best in everything that I did. Yeah.
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 Well, when you first trained at altitude, Did you notice any physiological effects?
No, I because I had gone to school at Denver. Yeah, so Denver is high altitude.
Mm-hmm.
So I was already accustomed to training at that kind of altitude, yeah. And then, like, Denver was dry cold. So Lake Tahoe was almost similar, yeah. You know, so it was good for me because I got to see another place that I never knew existed, yeah.
Mm.
And if it wasn't me playing for Outrigger Canoe Club, which was an exclusive white man club, I would never have experienced all of this. So for me, I'm very grateful in terms of what this organization did for me, because it showed me that, you know, wealth done for good things can bring plenty of happiness, and wealth, if you don't understand the value of this achievement, can bring plenty unhappiness, yeah? So I'm very grateful for this organization because that's what I got from them, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went into their organization, I only had one semester and one year and one semester of higher education. When I left, I had achieved a master's degree. So I was very thankful for that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize that I'm a very God-fearing person. So I'm always asking him for guidance and help and all that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my mentor left me with 7 words that I try to emulate every day of my life. And, you know, he taught me so many things that I'm very appreciative of him today. And he lives on the same island where I live too. But he's originally from the area where I grew up, Papakolea.
Hmm.
But now, so every time when I go home, I always drop by and say, you know, hello to him and thank him for helping me become what I am today, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful that you're able to do that.
Yeah, and then I always remember the 7 words that he shared with me, yeah. Yeah, he told me, you know, that the first 3 words was commitment, dedication, and sacrifice. You cannot pick and choose. You have to do all 3. And he said, when you do all 3, he said, that is your God-given right to success. You cannot be denied success.
Hmm.
So he said, when you achieve success, he says, the next thing is, how do you maintain success? So he said, the next 2 words you must do and remember is to be creative and innovative. He said, you don't complain that you don't have this, so you cannot achieve this. He said, God gave you a brain, so he's telling you how to create something so that you can still get the same result.
Hmm.
And then he said, the last 2 words is, once you achieve success, maintain success, he said, how do you perpetuate success? And he said, this is the hardest 2 words because there's a parable that goes with it. And he said, to do this, he said, you have to be able to understand that God puts on the face of this earth someone that is always greater than you. And he said, if you do not have humility and compatibility, he said, then this individual seeks you out and destroys you. If you have this, then this individual always passes you by. So this is the words of wisdom that he shared with me that I always, always try to be every day of my life.
That is really interesting, really good advice.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I was fortunate that God gave me this person, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Pete, I want to ask you a little bit more about the training for the Olympic Games. Did you ever do any weightlifting as part of your training for the Olympics?
No. I did only when I went to the training camp. But all my life, my training was in the ocean. So I did not realize how strong I was until I was put to the test of weightlifting on the mainland for the Olympics.
I see.
But outside of that, I never lifted weights.
How did your training compare to the Soviet Union, Japan, and Czechoslovakian regiment?
Well, first of all, their training had a different purpose. Their training had a different meaning because at that point in time, they were communists. But as far as the type of people they were all good people. It was just the politics that was involved, yeah, that made it look like it's a lopsided world, yeah.
Mm.
But they were good people. You know, everybody. See, I had gone to Japan to play basketball, so I was, you know, aware of the friendship that I developed, yeah, through the basketball. And so, for example, when you use the term manager, our immediate reaction is the manager is the water boy. But in Japan, the manager is the big shot. He runs the team. So, you know, as long as you can understand what each word meant for each group of people, then, you know, you would find out that they're not like what the media puts out, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
They're all good people. Actually, you know, if I want to know something, I never would go with the media or the politicians to learn about the country. I would go straight to the volleyball program and look where they're located and then talk to them because they'll tell you everything. They won't hold back.
Mm-hmm. So what did you learn about how the training regimen of the Soviet bloc countries in Japan and Czechoslovakia, how did their training and preparation for the Olympics compare to the U.S. team's training and preparation for the Olympics?
There was no freedom the way we had. Yeah, that was the first difference. That you know, when they're on their mission, it's totally different because more on the dictatorship, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But like I said, they're all good people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's, you know, it's like me talking to you and having a good feeling that you're very up and up and honest, you know, and yet I haven't seen you, but that's the type of things you portray when I talk to you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Pete, while you were in the training camp, getting ready for the 1968 games, did you ever remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. Track team?
Oh, say that again.
Do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. track team or basketball team?
No, I didn't know anything until it happened on the podium when they went to receive their medals.
Oh, okay.
Because then the next thing came out in the newspaper that we read in the village.
I see.
The Olympic Village. But, you know, But then I got to know them at a later date, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And they had their own agenda at the time, yeah? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, but it wasn't part of my agenda.
So,
go ahead.
I was just going to ask, so when they did raise their fists on the metal podium, how did you first learn about that? Was it from the newspaper article, or were you there at the stadium?
Oh, no. We was from the newspaper article.
Uh-huh. And what did what did you think about what they had done, Tommy Smith and John?
I didn't think anything except that, you know, they had their reasons, and I didn't want to know what their reasons, because I didn't think it was, you know, at that point in time, the right thing to do. But then, who am I to judge? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
No. I didn't know. I didn't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. Because I'm pretty sure that they didn't want anything to leak out. Otherwise, there would be all kinds of problems, yeah, politically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but I never knew about that.
Okay.
That problem.
Pete, when you first arrived in Mexico City for the games, what were your first impressions of the city and the people?
I enjoyed the people because they look just like the local people in Hawaii, you know, all the mixtures, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I got to see poverty at its lowest state, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And I saw wealth at its highest state at the same time, too, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, for example, I used to run around the village because I wanted to train. And I would train every morning. I run at the same time. And every morning I would see this young little boy with the father carrying a big bundle of sticks. I don't know what, you know, what they were for. I guess maybe firewood or whatever they was trying to sell or get for them or whatever, yeah? And so I used to collect all the goodies that was in the Olympic Village and put it in a bag, and I would run, and then when I see the boy, I would just put the bag in his hands with all the goodies, and I just looked at how hard his life was, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I used to every morning do that, you know, and I would always say, you know, aloha, you know,
mm-hmm.
And then just stick the bag in his hand and say, you know, God bless you, and then I just kept running, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, I had a lot of appreciation because I saw them as poor as dirt poor,
mm-hmm.
And I saw them wealthy as filthy rich, yeah. There were only two classes, yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
So did you go out into the city and did you go sightseeing around Mexico City?
No, I didn't do too much of that because my attitude when I go to different places is I'm there to do a job and not to, you know, go there to recreate, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so until everything is over, then I would, whatever little time left, then I would now enjoy.
Mm.
But my first objective is I'm here to do a job, man. So everything had a different outlook for me, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I could relate then, because I'm a poor boy. I'm coming from a poor family too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I understand what it is, yeah.
Pete, what did you think of the event venues and athletic facilities?
I thought it was fantastic. I thought the venues were really, really nice. And the facilities was excellent, you know. So I could see a poor country trying their best to show the world that they know how to go first class too, yeah. But I also saw that, you know, when you were poor, you were stuck, you know. So, you know, it had different meaning for me, but, you know, I just appreciated that I could see the difference, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was your impression of security measures, and how would you compare?
Security was excellent.
Oh, okay.
Because, yeah, security was excellent because you couldn't go in and out without being screened with your badge, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so as far as security, you know, it was good.
What about your accommodations in the Olympic Village, your room and the bed and the bathrooms there? What did you think of those facilities?
Oh, I thought it was good, except for one incident where they had mixed the juice with the water there, and a lot of people had gotten the Montezuma revenge. Yeah, but we didn't know that the people had done that, yeah.
Mm.
So, you know, it's just that, you know, we were fortunate that we had the medication that could go with it, yeah.
I see.
So you know, it was caught quick enough that everybody didn't have to have it for a long period of time, yeah.
Did anyone you know get very sick during any of your matches?
Some people did, but at that point, I first understood and heard the word mononucleosis, and I didn't even, you know what it was. So outside of that, nobody, you know, got sick in a sense like that, yeah.
Okay. Or who were your roommates?
You know, I don't even remember who was my roommate. You know, it's been so long that I just don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Who were your closest friends on the team?
The players, we were all close. The closest members on the team, you know, they were all my friends. But I didn't have any particular person outside of maybe Misty May's father, because he was originally born and raised in Hawaii. And so we kind of gravitated together, because both of us came from Hawaii.
Ah.
So if there was any person that was really close to me, it would have been Butch May. Jeez, you know, ironic that his daughter is one of the great sand volleyball players. And yet, you know, I never saw her have the opportunity to get involved with indoor, you know. Outside of the sand.
Hmm.
But he would have been my closest, only because he and I had the same thing in common. We both were from Hawaii, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the opening ceremony like?
The opening ceremony and the closing ceremony for me had a very, very valuable experience, because it's just seeing everybody trying to outdo, you know, one country trying to outdo the other country, you know, and the things that they created, that to me was very exciting. Mm. You know,
mm-hmm.
all the different creativities. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but it's exciting. It's exciting. The opening and closing ceremony always had a serious impact on my attitude. Yeah. You know.
Mm. Did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with people from other national teams?
Yes. Yes.
Can you tell me about some of those?
It was exciting to see that the women from the other countries who were like the track and field runners, and they looked like models, and yet they were athletes. I thought that was neat, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you would never look at them as athletes, yeah. But they were exceptional people in terms of beauty and everything, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that's a thing that, to me, shocked me the most.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they were so pretty, and I said, wow. And yet, they were track and field runners, you know? And I said, wow, man. You would never look at them like that, you know? That, yeah, to me, was something different, yeah?
Yeah. Why so?
Because, you know, you don't think of them to be beautiful women. You see them as athletes. So they're more on the tomboyish side, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But yet, when you see them in person, I went, wow, you know. But that was exciting for me.
Yeah. 1968 was a big time in terms of, an important time in terms of the Cold War and the Vietnam War. What effect, if any, did these wars and the political climate have on the games and the relationships between athletes from different countries, in particular the Soviet bloc countries and the United States?
Like I told you, you know, The athletes, we don't see that because they're all down-to-earth people. It's the politics that control their country that, and the media that makes it really lopsided.
Hmm.
You know, but as far as the athletes are concerned, you would never see that. You see them as regular people.
Did you have any memorable interactions with athletes from the Soviet bloc?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was impressed to see the lady that was the world shot put champion. And she was also a scholar in her country. But yet, she was huge, and she looked like she could pick me up and shot put me, you know. But she was a nice person. She mm-hmm. was a nice lady.
Hmm.
Yeah. But it's just the media and the politics that go with it and the way the media describes everybody that makes it ugly, yeah.
Okay.
You know.
Pete, can you describe what you remember most about the volleyball matches you had in 68?
The memorable thing was beating Russia, because we never was aware that we could beat them, yeah.
And why? Yeah. Why did you think you could not ever beat them?
Well, because they were considered the world's best at the time, yeah?
I see.
But, you know, for me, I didn't see it as, you know, they couldn't be beat. For me, it was just understanding that these were the people that were controlling the sport at the time. So that's the one. That's what I remember.
And how were they controlling the sport at the time?
Well, because they were always winning, yeah.
Okay. They were always winning. why were they always winning? What were they doing differently that gave them that competitive edge?
The discipline that they had. The good countries that play, they have a different discipline, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how were you able to beat the Soviet Union in that match?
They took us very lightly. They didn't expect us to win. So they didn't start off with their best team, yeah?
I see.
And volleyball has a different kind of pressure, yeah? That when you go ahead, it's kind of hard for catch up, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Because
you're not capable of turning it on and off at your leisure, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So at that point in time, it was kind of too late, yeah, before they realized that, you know, we had beat them. And then I said, okay, so this is what's going to happen. If they lose the next match, they're going to go to Siberia. So lo and behold, they won the whole thing, yeah? You know, that motivation of going to Siberia motivates them to the gold standard, yeah.
So are you just kidding, or did some of the, or is this true that if they did not win, they would be punished by being sent to Siberia?
Oh, yeah. That was a fact, you know. Because they were threatened, yeah, you know. So their whole practice session was like in secret, yeah, because you don't see them. They're in the village and then they're gone from the village, yeah, you know. Early in the morning.
So you even weren't sure of what their training regimen was necessarily because it was so secretive?
Yeah, because they were gone from the village early in the morning and came back very late that night. You know, because there's always one thing I like about the venues, there's always a 24/7 venue that is open where you can always feed your hunger, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's how I used to see them, yeah?
You would see them in the cafeteria?
I see them coming back into the village late at night, and I went, oh my goodness, they left early this morning, and they're coming back late at night.
Oh.
You know, and that's because we had beat them the opening match.
Yeah.
Yeah, so after that, they beat everybody. Yeah.
What else about those matches in 68 do you remember? Aside from beating the Soviets, is there anything else that sticks out in your mind from those matches?
Yeah. What sticks out in my mind is that Mexico has never repeated in the Olympics since the 68 games.
Has never hosted an Olympics or?
No. They outside of the 68 hosting, they have yet to be part of the Olympics in volleyball.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And you know, they're really nice people.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I had my way, and I had the opportunity, I would love to coach them.
To coach the Mexican volleyball team?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
I would love to if I had the opportunity. It's just that you got to know the right people, yeah?
Yeah.
And for me, I don't know the right people.
I see. So. Well, Pedro, when you were at the Olympic Games in 1968, were you aware of the urine testing for banned performance-enhancing substances?
Yeah, we were told about that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for me, it didn't bother me because I never had any drugs in my life, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that never, was an issue for me, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about the other athletes, but, for me, that was not a problem.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Did you have to take a test? Did you have to do the urine in the cup and all of that?
No, I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember ever having to take a test like that.
Okay.
But I know it was made aware to us.
Okay.
That, there might be random checking, yeah.
And how that didn't bother you at all?
No, because mm-hmm. I welcomed them with open arms, yeah. Because I had nothing to hide and, because I never did things like that, yeah, in my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Till today. Never drink, never smoke.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Pedro, had you heard about the gender verification testing that happened at the 1968 games?
I heard about it, but I never... witness, what took place.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard about it.
And what had you heard about it?
That there was some kind of discussion about that. And again, I only learned it through the media, yeah, in the village.
Mm-hmm.
And then for me, I don't pay attention too much, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I just came there for a purpose, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do my job and do the best I can, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Until the stuff is over, I'm not in the privilege to celebrate, yeah.
I see. Well, what did you do as soon as your event was over and you had completed your part?
Oh, I kind of hung with the Brazilian team. Because the setter and who's, I guess, just retired as a coach for Brazil, we were kind of close, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So I kind of hung with them, yeah.
Oh.
For example, when I was in the Sao Paulo, Brazil for the 63 Pan American Games, do you realize that LED lights were already in Brazil, and that's the first time I saw LED lights.
Really?
Yep, because that's the only lights that could penetrate the fog.
Interesting.
And only now it's publicized like mad in the U.S.
Huh.
Because the fog was so thick that I couldn't even see my hand. But the cars only had LED lights.
How interesting.
Yes, I thought it was very interesting.
Hmm. Pete, 1968 was a pivotal time in the American civil rights movement and in race relations in the United States. And Martin Luther King was assassinated in the spring of 1968. What effect, if any, do you think this climate had on Olympians and on the games?
Well, I remember 1960, the Nationals was held in Dallas, Texas. And I witnessed firsthand the discrimination. Remember I told you I was with an all-white club?
Mm-hmm.
And I we all go around together. We don't think about these kind of things, yeah. And when we went into this restaurant, it was water, 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 until it came to me and it stopped. Utensils, utensils, utensils came to me, it stopped. And then I realized that there was racial discrimination. So I jumped on the counter and I said, "Where's your manager? I want to speak to your manager." And they thought I was going to, you know, make a scene. And then, you know, they would call the police, yeah. So, but I witnessed. It wasn't a very pleasant thing, but I witnessed. And, you know, I witnessed firsthand. And then I went to Macy's, and I wanted to use the restroom, and I followed the lady's instruction, and she had given me the instructions to the black only. And I said, "Oh, wow." You know, they think I'm black when I'm Hawaiian, yeah? But they don't know the difference, yeah?
Interesting. You know?
Yeah, but that was my experience. So...
Did you feel that that form of racism at the Olympics or in any way?
No, no, I didn't. I didn't feel like that. Yeah, it was only in Dallas that I felt it, because that's where the national championship was at that time.
Okay. And you said that was 1960?
Yes, 1960. That's when it happened.
And that was the only time that you had ever experienced?
Well, that's when I felt firsthand the discrimination of racial tension, yeah.
So what did you think about, in 1968, the people who were protesting at the Olympic Games about racism and this kind of treatment?
Well, that's why I said they had their reasons, yeah. But, you know, I wasn't about to judge what was their reasons. They had the reasons to do it, and they did it. So, you know, if I had a cause, then I probably would do it, you know. But I never had the cause. So they had a cause, so they believed in the cause, and so that's why they performed as such. That's how I look at it, yeah.
Pete, did you get to witness any of the record-setting events, or did you even get to go to any other athletic events while you were there?
Yeah, in the 64, I witnessed Bob Hayes running the 100. It was something, you know.
Yeah.
And he was a huge person. And I said, "Whoa." And he still could run fast, you know. And that's when I saw the Romanian track women running. And I said, "Wow, they can run, you know." But yet, that's when I noticed that they never looked like women athletes. They look like models, yeah? Yeah, so. But yeah, that was exciting, you know, to get to see different events, yeah? And I got to see fencing, you know, something that I never saw before, you know?
Yeah. So. And what did you think of fencing the first time you saw it?
Oh, I thought it was fantastic. Of how they have to train, yeah, with all the different type of swords, yeah. So, was interesting. Yeah, but then you get to appreciate, yeah, because like first time you seen everything, yeah, you know.
Yeah. So. Pete, for you personally, what was the most memorable part of competing in the 1968 Games?
The most memorable of competing in the 68 games was just being a part of the whole program. That's what's memorable for me.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding what the country had to go through to just make it possible for all of this to happen, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how much they as individuals had to sacrifice too, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Pete, what are your specific memories of the closing ceremony in 1968?
My memories is that, you know, everything is coming to an end, and then now your friendship that you've made is going to be separated until such time you can see it again, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Or participate in it again, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to go to 4 Olympics and 4 Pan American Games, yeah?
Mm. That's a lot.
But it was possible except for the last two because now I wanted to go back to school, yeah.
Oh, I see.
So the last two was because of school that I didn't accomplish that, but yeah.
Mm. What did you do after the 1968 games? You returned to Hawaii and
then I went back to school.
Okay.
Because the 68 Olympic the assistant coach was the athletic director for Church College of Hawaii, which is now Brigham Young University of Hawaii, yeah?
Hmm.
And he was the athletic director, and he told me if I wanted to go to school, and I told him I couldn't because I didn't graduate with my class when I went to Denver University.
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh, no, because we're NAIA, so NAIA has different rules. And so the president of the college gave me one semester, which is all I needed, based on how he saw me raise my family. So he gave me that one shot in life, and everything became history.
Hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And then my assistant coach, who became my coach, programmed me from the day I entered into the college to the day I graduated to the day I went to graduate school in Provo, Utah.
Hmm.
So, and then I was accepted into the doctoral program. But I had already committed to my children that I would go home, yeah? Because they didn't want to stay there. So, you know. So that was my educational career.
Oh, that's wonderful. What has been the effect of being an Olympian on your life? So, in other words, you know, having been such a successful athlete and having been on the Olympic team twice, have people treated you differently? What has been the impact of being an Olympian?
Well, the people who know that you were this past athlete, they know, but I don't talk too much, yeah, about it, you know. I just, for me, you gotta earn respect. So, whether they're athletes or non-athletes, for me, I was taught that you have to earn the respect. So that's how I look at my life, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, you know, people see me as very successful, I see myself as being very privileged that God gave me this experience, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I see my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, regret anything, you know.
Pedro, or Pete, what has been your personal experience with amateurism and the rules of amateurism? Did you ever run into any problems with the eligibility rules during the 1960s?
No, I didn't see anything because it was cut and dry. You know, if you wanted to participate, this is what you had to be. And so, you know, I never saw it as a problem because I just saw it like, I want to be, so I got to be this. And it's not what I want to be, it's what I need to accept, yeah? You know, I just saw things different, yeah?
Pete, when you think about the state of amateurism as it is today, compared to what it meant to be an amateur in the 60s, what comparisons can you draw between amateurism then versus now?
Amateurism at that point was pure hardship struggles that you had a goal and objective. And that, you know, it was a struggle because you had to provide for yourself, yeah. Today, it's a world of issues because there is no lack of discipline and everybody wants everything on a silver platter, yeah. They don't want to work for it. They feel like it's an entitlement. And so that's how I see the difference, yeah. You know, before you gotta work, now they feel like it's my right to have it, you know.
What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Don't let anybody tell you cannot achieve your dreams. If you believe in your dreams, then you go for it. But, you know, understanding that there's ups and downs that you have to be a part of, yeah. That it's not impossible. And if you're God-fearing, ask God for help, and you'd be surprised how much He can open the doors for you.
Pete, since you were involved in multiple Olympic Games, I just want to ask you one last question before we close the interview. What in your mind, in your memory, are some of the biggest differences between Tokyo and Mexico City Olympic Games?
Tokyo was the difference to me was I saw the country from zero, and within the time span for the 64 Olympics had surplus because I saw a country come together. And Tokyo, and I mean, as far as Mexico, it was the wealthy trying to put on a show to the world that their country could do it, even though it was poor. But if you look real good, it was only the wealthy people that did the movement in Mexico. So, you know, that's the difference I saw. I saw one country as individuals trying to make a grandstand, and I saw another country pulled together as a unit to achieve everything, yeah.
I see. Well, comparing Tokyo and Mexico City, what are some of the biggest similarities that you noticed between the two Olympic hosts?
Oh, the similarities would be everybody trying to outdo everybody in the venues and in what, you know, it's a big show, yeah, you know, and how can I outdo the next country, yeah? You know, that's the way I see it. I see it as a big show, you know. And you know, everybody showing their political might and everything, yeah. But it comes down rich and poor, that's all, you know. So, but outside of that, it's a good experience so that, you know, it helps me to stay humble, yeah?
Mm.
Because of all the things I've seen, yeah?
Yeah. Well, Pete, before we close the interview, is there anything else that you would like to get on this record? Anything else that you'd like to tell us about?
Oh, no. I just enjoyed your, you know, the opportunity to talk to you and be part of your program.
Well, I've enjoyed it too. It's been a very interesting conversation, and thank you for being generous with your time and with your memories.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.